This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Granillo in for Dave Ross alongside Colleen O'Brien. And we are now joined by CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger to talk about a partial trade deal between the U.S. and China. They are calling this phase one of the deal. So, Jill, what's in it?
Well, I think the most important thing to know about this deal is what did not happen. We were supposed to get another round of tariffs starting yesterday at midnight, where we would see a slew of Chinese consumer goods get tariffed. That would mean everything from your iPhone to your tablet to your TV to your clothing and your bags and your shoes. All those consumer goods would have been included in that next round of tariffs. And with phase one of this deal, those tariffs have been put on the back burner, not going to be put in place. We also saw the reduction in the tariff rate on a couple on $120 billion of goods that come in from China, so down from 15% to 7.5%. We still are going to have 25% tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese imports, so that remains in place. But in exchange for all of this, China has agreed to increase its purchase of American food and energy and manufactured goods and services. Should total about $200 billion over the next couple of years. For farmers, this is really important because there is a part of that that includes an increase from the $8 billion or so of agricultural products that the Chinese are buying from us to nearly $40 billion over the course of the next couple of years.
So, I mean, it's been nearly 2 years now since this trade war started. All along, President Trump has essentially said that the U.S. has just been getting ripped off by China. Now, with all of this, does the U.S. look like it's coming out on top?
Let's say TBD, to be determined on that.
Okay.
And the reason is that if you ask most U.S. business people, and look at maybe the Chamber of Commerce or the sort of the big groups, what they are seeking is a fairer playing field in China to do business. And while this phase one does give a little bit of a nod to the Chinese saying, oh, yes, we're going to make it easier for U.S. companies to do business here, there are no specifics yet. And potentially that's coming in the next round of talks. But the core issue that remains is if you are a United States company, you want to do business in China, you are forced to hand over your technology. This is the so-called technology transfer, or partner with a Chinese company in a joint venture. And I think that until we see that part of the plan in action, it is hard to claim that this was all worth it. We really must see a way that U.S. companies can do business in China without these strings attached.
So what does the next phase look like then? Because we're calling this phase one. What is phase two? When could that happen?
Well, I think that the hope is that it happens next year. The next phase, I think, is more detailed. It sort of gets to the harder issues. And, you know, interestingly enough, in the past, if you look at how U.S. and China trade talks have gone, they usually break down along these lines around technology transfer. And also in the past, we've talked about human rights violations. Now, we haven't heard a word about human rights in this round of talks. It's not even on the table. But I think until we see a way for companies to be able to do business in China, and I'm not sure that happens next year because there's going to be pushback from the Chinese government, I don't see this all playing out. Maybe it simply looks like phase one is the unwinding of the damage done from the tariffs themselves. I'm not sure we've gotten a ton out of this. Remember that U.S. agricultural producers have really taken it on the chin, and certainly so has the manufacturing sector.
So I want to shift now to some big local news that we have that will have major impacts on the global economy. Reports now this morning are that Boeing could announce sometime this week that it could halt production of the 737 MAX. This plane, of course, has been grounded since March. What are the worldwide implications of a potential halts of production?
Well, I'm going to go start with the micro to the macro. Mm-hmm. So obviously, this is not just the folks who are impacted directly in the MAX facility. But remember, all the different subcontractors that depend on the production of the MAX, I think that they are really bracing for some potential losses. Also, I think that it's important to note that Some of this is very company specific, and while it's a terrible tragedy that occurred, companies have come out of terrible tragedies like this to thrive. I think that what we're really waiting to see is whether or not Boeing can get this issue resolved so that everyone feels safe and comfortable with the process, but also that they can do it in such a way so that they convince the government, hey, our reporting and whistleblowing procedures are in place. It works for us. This is what's important here. And that they then get they get back in action, hopefully by the end of the first quarter, you know, February, March. And then from the world's point of view, I think this is really a theme of corporate America, which is you have to listen when your people are telling you there are problems. I think that what we see time and time again, whether it's from the financial crisis, whether it is even more mundane issues like a Wells Fargo employee says, hey, someone's really putting pressure on me to open up accounts, to Boeing, where some of the engineers felt like their safety concerns weren't being heeded. I think that corporate America is waking up. They've got to listen to their people.
CBS Senior Business News Analyst Jill Schlesinger, thank you so much.
Take care.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Aaron Granillo in for Dave Ross. Cairo Radio is raising money this month for Treehouse, a nonprofit supporting our state's foster kids. But it is not just the kids benefiting from what Treehouse does best. Many of the workers there who mentor the youth say they, too, learn important lessons, like what it means to have grits. Here's Cairo Radio's Miley Katie.
Sarah Birch wasn't in the foster care system herself, but she knows what it's like to lean on mentors to get through adolescence.
It was really fantastic to have an adult who understood me as a whole person and who supported my decisions and my future. And the best part of what I get to do 40 hours a week is be that person for other teenagers.
40 hours a week, she is an education specialist for the Treehouse Graduation Success Program. Sarah says sometimes that work isn't pen and paper. It's finding a way to meet a kid where they're at when trouble is brewing at school.
This afternoon, I'm taking a student bowling for his birthday, and last week I visited a girl in detention.
The work also includes helping foster youth choose classes, navigate homework, and always be there as a support system outside the classroom. She counsels students who come from tragic backgrounds with parents who couldn't take care of them. But she says these kids want to work hard to create better futures.
They have their own dreams and they have a life that's bigger than what's happened to them.
And that, she says, is where she learned what it means to have grit.
Maybe if there's a voice inside of their head that says you're not good enough or you will never be such and such, to show up in spite of or perhaps because of that and to create a life that they feel they can be proud of, that's what I think of when I think of grit.
These are lessons both in and out of the classroom made possible by Treehouse and donors like you.
It sounds cheesy to say, but donating to Treehouse allows that type of work to happen. It makes it possible for me to take a 19-year-old bowling for his birthday. And I can tell you that no one else is going to do that.
Join Cairo Radio and Treehouse for another year of holiday magic. Text MAGIC to 98973 to find out how you can help make the holidays bright for kids in foster care.
That's Cairo Radio's Miley Katie.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. It turns out that measles is more insidious than we thought. Let's get the latest research.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Here's Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. This will, again, be an appeal for people to get vaccinated, but there is now an even better reason than just preventing the measles. It has to do with measles' effect on the human immune system. So what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so this is a new study out of Harvard University that was published in Science. What was interesting about this study is this. Now we know that measles can cause other problems, that if you get measles, it's not just the acute illness with the spots and fever, but rather it's affecting the body's immune memory. It's causing immune amnesia. It's actually causing the body to lose or forget its immune memory that preserves resistance to other infections. So it's actually making us more vulnerable, not just to measles, but to all kinds of other viral infections. So the bigger picture from this is that if you get the measles vaccine, not only are you protecting yourself against the measles itself, but you're actually protecting your body's entire immune system.
So let me get this straight. If you contract measles and you get through the illness, then if you had a shot for, whooping cough or diphtheria or tetanus, it could potentially undo the beneficial effects of those shots?
Right. So we have different antibodies in our body, and these antibodies protect us against viruses and bacteria, and our immune system has memory. So we are immune to certain things, anything from influenza to herpes viruses or mm-hmm. to bacteria that cause pneumonia and skin infections. We build up antibodies that help to protect us from these things. And in this study done that was published in Science, the researchers showed that the measles virus wipes out between 11% to 73% of these different antibodies that protect us against these viral and bacterial strains. So, yeah, what's happening is that the measles isn't just causing its own acute illness, but it's actually injuring the rest of our immune system.
So by skipping the measles vaccine, you potentially are unvaccinating yourself against everything else?
Yeah, that's a really clever way of actually stating it. Yeah, it's not that by not getting the measles vaccine, but it's by not getting the measles vaccine and then contracting measles,
right?
Yeah. That you then, as you said, sort of unvaccinate yourself.
Because over time, it's not just the stuff you're vaccinated against, but there are hundreds of cold viruses, as I understand it.
And right. So, absolutely.
And so you're building up your immunity to that.
That's an excellent point, right? Yeah. You're protecting your body protects itself. Your body develops its own antibodies against these viruses and bacteria. And this is our so-called immune memory. And the measles sort of wipes out our immune memory. The authors were able to quantify it between 11 and 73%.
Now, did they see this by actually testing the blood and noticing that some of these antibodies were missing after measles infection, or is this also a statistical study?
No, they did that. They actually measured antibodies in the bloodstream and were able to actually see that. It was a direct measurement. That's how they were able to quantify it. It was not just a statistical association.
Wow. Well, I guess if you're waiting for that one additional reason to get vaccinated, that would seem to be it. I mean, because that means that the measles isn't just a one-off disease. It compromises your body's natural immunity. And if the idea of not getting vaccinated is to, because you're deferring to your body's natural immunity, there might be a flaw in that logic.
For example, if a person has 100 different antibodies against, say, chickenpox before contracting the measles, and then they get the measles, they might emerge from having had the measles with only 50 different antibodies, essentially cutting their chickenpox protection in half. Again, the effect of the vaccine is to prevent the measles, but the measles, as we know it, is an acute illness. But what they're showing is that measles isn't just an acute illness, but it's actually, as you said, it's sort of unvaccinating yourself. It's affecting the rest of our body's immune system. Look, the notion of not getting vaccinated is something called vaccine hesitancy, and it's really a reluctance or essentially a refusal to be vaccinated. It's actually identified by the World Health Organization as one of the top 10 global health threats in 2019. We're seeing the effects of it. And remember that this is all based on not only flawed science, but forged science. The doctor who conducted the research was stripped of all of his credentials. But from this came this whole anti-vax movement. And it's unfortunate because we're seeing an increase, especially in the United States, of diseases that were either well controlled or previously eradicated. So, I would continue to make the plea that people really need to get vaccinated because it's a super important public health issue.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
A new regional approach to homelessness in Seattle and King County could be coming down very soon. Cover Radio's Hannah Scott joins us now with details on today's votes. Hannah.
Yeah, Aaron, today this Seattle City Council will take a final vote on this today, and this is really a long time coming. For years now, experts have been saying that our fragmented approach to homelessness here in Seattle and King County is a big part of the problem and the reason that we don't see a lot in the way of progress. It was a year ago this month that we finally got this announcement from the county executive and the mayor.
Mayor Durkin and I will work with our respective councils to produce formalized agreements between our two governments. But let's be clear, we will stand up, we will staff, and we will fund a new entity. combining the homelessness work of King County, of Seattle, of All Home, and of our partners.
Now, in the months since, there's been a ton of work that has been done to finally create a plan to come up with this new regional homeless agency and to fund it. Last week, the King County Council approved that plan after some last-minute changes that shifted the bulk of the authority away from a board made up of experts on homelessness, including people with lived experience, and handed most of the authority to a 12-member governing board mostly made up of elected officials. Now, when the County Council voted last week, some still had concerns, and it wasn't necessarily the exact plan everybody wanted, but Councilmember Claudia Balducci made this point.
I think it's important for us to always touch back to remembering why we're having this discussion in the first place, and that is that what we're doing currently isn't getting us where we want to be. It's really not working. We've had studies, we've had roundtables, we've had ad hoc and standing committee presentations, we've had consultants, but you don't really need to step far outside the doors of this building to see that what we're doing isn't working.
And County Councilmember Jeannie Cole Wells, who had actually negotiated the last-minute changes in order to get the suburban cities in the county on board, said while this plan was not perfect, it was a compromise and a good place to start.
So in the end, I believe that we've come up with something pretty good. Absolutely not ideal, but it is something that we can base our working together regionally.
It did end up passing the King County Council unanimously. The next day, Seattle City Council Special Homeless Committee voted. And while it did pass that committee last Thursday, there were concerns from Lorena Gonzalez about things not included in this plan that the city wants.
There are some important items that were included in the underlying ILA that are important to continuing to move forward on this issue to meaningfully address the experience that individuals are unfortunately having with homelessness. That being said, I also believe that there are a few areas, a handful of areas, of the dozens and dozens of policy decisions that have already been made by the RPC and by the King County Council. I'm literally focusing on three.
Now, the areas that she's got concerns with and others on the council have concerns with is whether or not this agency will use evidence-based practices in coming up with things. So that's things like housing first, right? Where you first worry about getting somebody's shelter, not about whether they're sober or doing drugs or not. You know, things like safe injection sites, that kind of philosophy. Whether they're using any evidence-based practices to harm reduction models, things like that, to help people get off the streets.
And the council is developing this plan based on, of course, these best practices from around the nation, right? So where did the city look to exactly to find out what's working? Did they look to other cities dealing with chronic homeless problems?
Oh, absolutely. And so you'll have what the city of Seattle and the Seattle City Council will best practices that they will pull from. And they're not wrong. There are many, many models across the country and many, many experts who say you absolutely have to work with the housing first model, right? You need to first get those folks into shelter. And if they're still using, then that's just what has to happen. You can stabilize them once they're housing or in housing, because that's the overall problem. And in fact, the original plan to start work on creating this agency way back when, a year ago, specifically said in it that we were going to create this plan with that housing first model. That language was in there. So that's the kind of thing they want to look at.
I wonder how the new authority will be held accountable. Are there going to be benchmarks to meet in terms of finding people housing?
And that will be things that they will be, as this agency is eventually created, which will have to deal with an implementation board and then selecting a governing board, that will definitely have to be something that happens, that they will have to meet benchmarks. Everybody's going to have to agree on what those are. So what you have is a 12-member governing board. It's going to have three representatives from Seattle, three from King County, three from the other suburban cities in other outside or in King County, and then also three people with lived experience dealing with homelessness.
This is interesting because Seattle is actually, aren't they fronting, it's like 60% of this plan, but they only have about, what you're saying, like a quarter of
the
vote.
Right? That is correct.
Why is that?
That's just the way that this ended up playing out in the changes, the last minute changes that happened, because in order to get the suburban cities to be part of this, and that's the idea, to have this regional approach, right? Now, they're not kicking any money in from their city budgets, but they do have tax dollars going to the county, so they count, and they wanted a voice, and they got those three seats at the table, which they were not originally going to have. Now, Seattle is, again, like you said, putting in 60% of the money, $73 million, and if they don't, they passed an ordinance last week along with this plan out of committee saying if we don't get the expectations that we want, making sure on the vote threshold to change certain policies and also this evidence-based practice as far as anything we're going to implement, we've got a nuclear option. And that nuclear option is that a year from now, we can pull our funding if you're not living up to these expectations that we have. So that sets us up for today's vote. Councilmember Gonzalez seemed to be the only one. She abstained in last week's vote. I don't think there's any votes to stop this from passing today. She was hoping to get some written assurances, though, from both the mayor and the King County Council that those city expectations would be implemented down the road.
Okay, so all signs pointing to this thing passing, correct?
Absolutely. And it's a landmark day for this area.
When would all of these changes happen?
They would start right away working into 2020. It would be about a year, I think, before we had an agency actually up and running with a CEO and a governing board and all of that in place.
Okay, and I know you said Seattle's paying, what, $73
million? Full budget is $132 million, so 73 from the city, and the rest is from King County.
Okay, all right. That's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you so much, and we will certainly check back with you once the city council potentially passes this plan.
That'll be this afternoon at 2.
This dose of kindness today about an elderly Albuquerque, New Mexico woman who dialed the wrong number in search of a walker. And it turned out to be a happy mistake. Here's Brittany Bade from CBS affiliate KRQE.
And I was wondering if you had a tall walker for a 5-foot person.
After 4 unanswered calls, Bernice decided to leave a voicemail. She thought she was calling a medical supply store.
If you do, would you please call.
But had accidentally got the last digit wrong. She had actually been calling a special agent at the Bernalillo County District Attorney's Office.
I put it on speakerphone and played it for everybody. It was a different kind of missed call, and it was kind of cute and humorous at the same time.
When he called back to sort things out,
she just said, I'm trying to get a hold of anybody with a walker.
Instead of just telling her she had the wrong number, the special agent and other analysts decided to find the walker for her.
We might have purchased 3 walkers before we got it right.
Then yesterday, 8 employees with the DA's office showed up at her door to surprise her with it.
This is about right, guys.
Is that right? It can go lower. Do you want it lower?
And the surprise did not stop there.
How much do I owe you?
0.
All of the employees chipped in, paying for the walker themselves. But the thoughtful gift was just part of her excitement.
Oh, boy, you bought me lots of hugs.
They all wanted to meet you.
Oh, I just love you to pieces.
She loved the hugs most of all. Just another reminder to, I guess if you have elderly family or even neighbors, just pay them a visit this time of year and say hello.
Yeah, I love her reaction. That was so genuine.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? Just such a surprise. And you could tell she loved the company, too, that most of all. It's like, great, the walker, but hey, you guys are here. Yeah. You want to talk, you know? So it reminds you to visit the people who don't get visited a lot.
Good message this morning. This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Granillo in for Dave Ross this morning. Colleen O'Brien alongside. Time now for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. You can hear Stacey Ross weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacey. The Seahawks headed to the playoffs, beating Carolina yesterday. A few hours later, the Cowboys beat the Rams. So at the very least, right now, we have the Seahawks with a wild card spot. And then, to top it all off, the 49ers lost to Atlanta. All in all, Stacey, a pretty darn good Sunday.
Yeah, no, the Seahawks got plenty of help from other teams, like you said, to not only clinch that playoff spot, but the hope is still very much alive for the number one seed. So the Saints play tonight. So if you're a Seahawks fan, you're rooting for the Saints to lose because otherwise they once again have the best record. And don't forget that they beat you back in week 3. So they have that head-to-head tiebreaker. So you're rooting against the Saints tonight. And then other than that, week 17 sounds like what it's all going to come down to for the number one seed or the wild card, that game between the Seahawks and the 49ers. I wouldn't be shocked to see it flex to Sunday night since it'll be for the number one seed. But yeah, hope still very much alive for Seattle. Not only that, but they once again have a ticket to the playoffs.
Okay, so once again, the Hawks decided to make it close at the end. Games that they were winning pretty solidly, like we saw yesterday, then they decide to keep it close again. This is sort of their pattern, I guess, for success at this point.
Yeah, we've been having this debate too about whether or not the Seahawks are the team or the league's luckiest team. There was a ESPN stats and info tweet that came out last night that the Seahawks have won the most games. I think they had 10 or higher, the most games by one score or fewer since the Houston Oilers in 1978, which obviously don't exist anymore. Yeah, so we've talked about before whether or not this team is lucky, because you look at other teams, the Dallas Cowboys and the LA Chargers are two other teams that are in games by a very small margin, but Danny O'Neill calls them the bizarro Seahawks because they've ended up losing, especially in the case of the Chargers, they've ended up losing most of those contests. So it's kind of two sides of the same coin, but what leads to a win, right? I think when you have such a small point differential, you start looking at the non-tangible things that lead you to a win. Can you stay calm under pressure? Do you make the right play at the right time? Those are all things that still help you win, even if it, you know, doesn't help you blow out another team.
Well, and on that note too, Stacey, your conversation with Russell Wilson just last week and how he keeps himself focused. And, you know, he had that on-mic segment with ESPN where people were kind of ribbing him for his positivity. But I think all of that plays a big part in the Seahawks pulling through and getting these wins.
Absolutely. And then you look at the way that he's kind of done that for years and the fact that the Seahawks have been one of the most successful franchises, at least the most successful franchise behind the New England Patriots, at consistently having 10 plus win seasons or consistently having winning seasons, that is, since they had 9 wins 2 years ago. But you start to think, well, that's got to be a factor, right? It's not just this thing he does for show. It's a mindset that he and Pete Carroll both really believe in. And, you know, you got to buy into it if you're part of that system. So clearly it's helped them. And it's pretty hard to knock it when you've seen the kind of success they've had.
Yeah, the national broadcasters were even talking about this on the broadcast yesterday. They talked about the culture that is cultivated here in Seattle and the fact that it can help a guy like Josh Gordon, who's had a bit of a troubled past. And we saw him yesterday, well, with the bad interception, but that just amazing catch that he had also.
Yeah, and one of my favorite Jake Heap's conspiracy theories, he has few, but they're great, the ones he does have. One of my favorite is he thinks that Josh Gordon really wanted to come to Seattle. Mm-hmm. So when Josh Gordon was waived by the Patriots, the Seahawks could claim him from the waiver wire, which is where every other team gets a shot at signing him. But the Seahawks' record at the time made them number 28 on that list. So they had to wait for 27 other teams to pass him. So Jake's theory is that Josh Gordon or his agent might have kind of feigned some like lack of interest or done something to make the other teams a little less interested so that he could land with Seattle, mm-hmm. because he at multiple occasions has said not only that he wants to stay here, but that this is a place where he really felt like it fit and where he it felt right. And he has a good relationship with Russell Wilson, who is another big part of why he came here. So yeah, it sounds like that's the perfect example of Pete Carroll's system working to help foster a new environment or kind of a second, third, fourth chance for guys.
What do you think was the biggest factor yesterday in the Seahawks win? Was there a certain player? Was there a certain play? What went well?
Good question. The offense turned things around after not scoring at all last week for the first time since week one of 2017. They scored on their first three possessions. That put them ahead, and it helped out for a defense that was short 6 starters. But I think you've also got to give credit to Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, who had 3 interceptions. They only got points, a field goal off of one of them, which was KJ Wright's second pick, but all 3 kind of bailed Seattle out of tricky situations. And you wonder what would have happened had they not. So like on Bobby's, the Carolina Panthers were in field goal range, so they could have scored there, but Bobby intercepted it to effectively end the first half. On the other, KJ Wright intercepted it when they were kind of getting some steam going. And don't forget that Josh Gordon on a trick play, look, he's got a great arm. He's got a lot of strength, but not super accurate.
Not accurate, yeah.
Not accurate. On a trick play by Josh Gordon, it was intercepted. And KJ Wright gives them the ball back by intercepting it again. So I think I'm going to say the momentum changer effort goes to those guys.
All right. That's our sports insider, Stacey Ross. Thanks for the time this morning.
Thanks, guys.
This is Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Granillo in for Dave Ross. Scientists have carried out the largest study on transgender children. The results show the kids have a strong sense of identity from very early ages. Celine Gugos led this study. She is a researcher at the University of Washington. Well, thanks for being here, Celine.
Thank you for having me. The main finding is that when we tested 3 to 12-year-old transgender children with typical measures of gender development that have been used for decades in research looking at cisgender children's development, we found that transgender children show strong identification and preferences in things like toys and clothing that's aligned with their current gender and not the gender that's associated with their assigned sex.
And that has nothing to do with how they were raised, you're saying, as well.
Yeah, so what we found in addition is that the length of time they've spent as transgender, so after having socially transitioned, did not affect the findings. And in addition, we collected some photo evidence. So we asked parents to send us photos of their children's first 3 years during special occasions. So things like birthdays, Halloween, holiday pictures, things we thought that first all parents would have, and also situations where parents would be more likely to dress their child for these special occasions, especially during their first 3 years. And then we had blind coders code for what they saw in these photos. And we found that transgender kids, when they were really young, were dressed by their parents in a way that was associated with their assigned sex and not their current gender. So in other words, that suggests that there wasn't anything different that these parents were doing in terms of gender socialization early on.
It sounds like what the study is suggesting is that regardless of how a child is raised or influences from their parents, the decision to want to transition is something that comes from within. Is that what the study is essentially saying?
Well, we didn't, because all the kids in our study had already socially transitioned, we can't really speak to the process of how the decision to transition comes about within this particular study. But what we are finding is that, yes, what you said is correct in the sense that regardless of how they, what sort of direct socialization they receive from their parents early on, these kids appear to have an internal sense of who they are, and they then look out into society to see what it means to be a girl or a boy, depending on how they feel, and then it looks like they're affected by that socialization more. So they're figuring out what their gender is first, and then looking out and seeing how they should sort of be that gender.
So I know there are going to be parents out there, families out there who hear this study, and they are going to say that teaching young children, I mean, the study looked at kids as young as 3, teaching them about trans issues will confuse them at a young age. Does the study take that at all into account? The fact that, you know, some say children should not be allowed to transition, that doing so perpetuates, you know, damaging gender stereotypes.
Well, like I said, because the kids in the study had already socially transitioned, we can't really speak to the process of transitioning, or the study doesn't really have anything to say in terms of who should or shouldn't transition. In terms of perpetuating stereotypes, however, the study does show that not all trans girls, for example, want to wear, you know, your stereotypical frilly pink dresses or play with dolls. So even though on average we found that, again, I'll use the example of transgender girls, even though on average we found that they were more inclined towards toys and clothing that were stereotypically associated with girls in our society, we also found a variation, a range, in terms of how extremely stereotypical their preferences were. And this range matched what we found within cisgender kids as well. So what that means is that in both our transgender and cisgender samples, we found kids who had counter-stereotypical preferences. So we had tomboys in both the transgender group and the cisgender group. So we're seeing that plenty of trans kids are violating these stereotypes just as much as cisgender kids do so. So the idea that trans kids are perpetuating stereotypes doesn't actually appear to hold up.
Where do you see this study of yours fitting into the larger conversation and the larger debate about transgender children and transgender issues?
I'll start with a limitation of the study. So one of the limitations of the study is that because we were looking for socially transitioned kids, that means at early age, social transitions require a lot of family support. So these kids were a specific group of kids who are being supported by their families and allowed to socially transition. So while these were necessary factors in our study to understand development of socially transitioned kids, they also mean that we don't know how the results would have been different if we had studied kids who identify as transgender but have not yet transitioned, or kids who live in less supportive environments. So these are questions still open for future research. But what I think the current study does provide is a foundational resource, an understanding of a baseline understanding of what transgender kids' gender development looks like. And I think this is of interest to, you know, parents who have transgender kids or practitioners who are working with transgender kids or gender nonconforming kids, as well as researchers, because there really isn't much out there that we know about these kids.
All right. Celine Gulgos, researcher at the University of Washington, studying young transgender children. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thanks again for having me.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.